Middle East Studies at Marine Corps University presents Israel's Security Amidst Regional Turmoil by Professor Ephraim Inbar, Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies. Ephraim Inbar is a professor in political studies at Bar-Ilan University and director of the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies. Professor Inbar was educated at the Hebrew University and at the University of Chicago. He served as visiting professor at Johns Hopkins University and Georgetown University, and a visiting scholar at the Woodrow Wilson's International Center for Scholars. Professor Inbar was appointed as a Manfred Warner NATO Fellow, was a visiting fellow at the London International Institute for Strategic Studies, and was a recipient of the Onassis Fellowship. Professor Inbar's area of specialization is Middle Eastern strategic issues with a special interest in the politics and strategy of Israeli national security. He has written over 80 articles in professional journals and edited volumes. He has also authored 5 books. Professor Inbar served in the Israel Defense Force as a paratrooper. He was a member of the Political Strategic Committee of the National Planning Council and the chair of the Committee for the National Security Curriculum at the Ministry of Education. He served on the Academic Committee of the History Department of the IDF and as the President of the Israel Association of International Studies. This lecture took place Thursday, 1 November 2012 at Marine Corps Base Quantico, Marine Corps University.
We'll speak about Israel's security amidst regional turmoil. And like everything is the Israeli army, my remarks will be divided into three. First of all, a few remarks about Israel's strategic environment, what's happening around us. Second, how does it affect Israel's national security? And third, what Israel can do about it. We've seen the Arab Spring, which in my view is a misnomer. However, there were eventful developments in the Middle East, which are partly new, but most of them not very new. And I want to emphasize three trends which started before the Arab Spring and continue and were amplified by the Arab Spring. The first is the weakening of the Arab state. Basically, the Arab states face a long crisis politically, economically, socially, and they fail to model. We see a grand failure to modernize those countries, and this is precisely at a certain point we see the masses coming out and demonstrating against the dictators that fail to deliver the goods that they can see other people are getting on TV. Now we live in an era which news from abroad are easily accessible, and the novelty about the situation, of course, is they lost the fear. Our part of the world, you demonstrate and you may risk your life. It's not like demonstrating in the streets of Paris or in the streets of Los Angeles. It takes a certain risk in expressing your views about the leaders. Part of the Arab world remained as it was, because most leaders remained in power. We have some new leaders. The most important, of course, is in Egypt, because Egypt is the most important Arab country. Again, unfortunately, I'm not sure the changes for the better. Basically, we see a new elite coming into power, which has Islamic roots, Islamic ideology. And from this point of view, modernization, which I think is a key for progress for those countries, this is not an elite that will bring about modernization. The Islamists are not an agent for modernization. They are not an Ataturk that pushed Turkey into a modern world. And the growing political clout of Islamic groups in Egypt and elsewhere is not beneficial for those states getting out of the crisis they have been with for maybe 100 years. Part of the countries were fragmented. We see countries losing grip over their territory. Of course, this is a result of civil war. Everybody sees what's happening in Syria. To some extent, Libya is in a similar situation with militias roaming around, and the central authorities unable to assert the control over the country. Yemen, similar, and even Egypt, which has always been the strongest state, is probably the only true historic state in the region, is losing part of control over its territory. And I'm not talking only about Sinai, which everybody knows that it's a Somalia. I'm talking even about the Delta area, when there is no law and order. And we see Coptic churches being burned. This is not what the government wants to happen. And there is a serious problem of central control, even in Egypt, which, as I mentioned, is a historic state, in contrast to other states in the Middle East, like Syria, Iraq, or Jordan, which all are new states with no clear national identity, or not as clear at least as Egyptians. A second trend is the rise of non-Arab actors. Parallel to the weakening of the Arab state, we see other actors in the Middle East filling in the vacuum. The first, of course, is Iran. The second is Turkey. And those two countries are large countries, over 70 million people. There are only three countries like this, of this size in the Middle East, the two of them and Egypt. And both countries, Turkey as well as Iran, have an imperial tradition. Basically, they have ruled in the past this area of the Middle East for centuries, having aspirations, appetite for playing a larger role, maybe a hegemonic role in the region. Iran, since the revolution in 79, adopted also another layer of identity, is a very Islamist, radical Shiite version, and the jihadist agenda to export the revolution, to export their version of Shia. And Iran has at its disposal a great asset. It gets $70 to $80 billion a year from exporting oil, which makes it an important player, even more important player in the Middle East. Turkey, for years, because of the Kemalist tradition, preferred the hands-off policy of the Middle East. For good reason, it's not such a nice neighborhood. You keep away from it. That's the feeling of most Israelis, of course. So, since 2002, we see a new leadership, again, a domestic change of dramatic consequences. A new party, AKP, with Erdogan, it's the leader, changing this policy, which actually started even earlier. The Turks decided they want to be the leaders of the Middle East. I never understood why, but they want to lead the Middle East, fine, that's their wish. And we see now, basically, a country that is distancing itself from the West. I know that they are in NATO. Actually, they have the largest army in NATO, with the exception of the United States. And the Turks, in contrast to other Europeans, are ready to fight. They're not Italians, those guys are ready to fight. So this makes it a different army. You just don't count soldiers. There is a certain esprit de corps that makes them ready to march. And they have also experience because of the PKK situation. And in recent years, Turkey under the AKP is definitely, in my view, a less reliable ally of the West. It courts the radical Islamic movements, Hamas, Hezbollah. I can understand that some of my Turkish friends, and I invested a lot of time in Turkey, like Palestinians, but why Hamas? They can choose PAs, Abbas. That's indifferent, but still, you know, there is a difference, or at least outside. So they are helping the Iranians. They voted against the United States, the United Nations Security Council, on sanctions on Iran. So they are definitely not the typical, you know, Western European powers. They accepted for a visit Ahmadinejad. What kind of civilized nation accepts Ahmadinejad for a visit? Colombia, that's a different story. But apart from, you know, this type of people, usually you don't accept Ahmadinejad for a visit, or the butcher from Sudan. Anyway, so we see a new foreign policy orientation on part of the Turks, and they also were an empire, have the appetite, and we see a foreign policy with great neo-Ottoman and Islamic impulses. There is talk, I don't know, I must say, I don't know how accurate it is, of the resurrection of the caliphate in Istanbul, but this fits to some extent what's happening in this country. So those are two nations who are trying to impose their will, their influence on the Middle East. There is talk of, you know, Turkey being a model. I'm not sure the Arabs are really going for it, because ethnic identities are still very strong in the Middle East, and there is a lot of historic animosity between Persians and Arabs, between Turks and Arabs. Allow me to be politically incorrect. When I was in Turkey, I heard a lot of Arab jokes, and I even enjoyed them. So this is type of ambiance that you have in Turkey. So those are the two rising countries. Israel is, of course, a third important actor. We don't have an imperial past. And we have no appetite for more territory or for greater influence. I know some people in Israel say that we have more than we need. So, but it is a strong country with a strong economy, a strong military. The military is a society that is ready to fight. And obviously, Israel cannot be a model for the Arab world, for obvious reasons, because they don't like us. A third trend is, and I emphasize the word, perceived retreat of American power. I'm sure you know that there is a literature about the decline of America. I personally do not subscribe to it. I think America is strong. It will snap back. The hegemony of America for in international affairs, in my view, is assured for the next 20, 30 years. But in the Middle East, the picture is different. In the Middle East, what they see, a weak America. And the beginning of this process started with your adventures in Afghanistan and Iraq. You decided to bring democracy to this area. You are a big power, you are entitled to your idiosyncrasies. But actually, I advise my best, I have a lot of neocon friends, Paul Wolfowitz of Chicago, and others, Zalmay Khalizad. So, and I told them, forget about democracy, but you know, we saw me as being a kufa, non believer.
Yeah.
So, I admit, I'm not a believer like that. So, but by now, you know, a few years, it transpired that you are not very successful, and as many suspected, the Americans don't have, you know, what Condoleezza Rice said, you should have multi-generational commitment, you know, unless you talk about very, you know, small generations. And this was not there, and eventually, you know, we decided to go home in Afghanistan. You have a date already to go home. And this mishap on part of American policy perceived, was perceived as weakness. So Americans go in, don't get what they want, and don't know how to deal with a complicated situation. And now this was amplified, with the current administration, which started with the engagement policy of Iran and Syria, which are enemies of the United States. And again, engagement sounds very nice for liberal ears in America. But engagement in the Middle East sounds entirely different. And it's a cultural, I understand, it's a cultural problem. In the Middle East, you don't engage, meaning be nice. Yes, engage is to be nice to him, to give him a chance. You know, I like you. I'm not so dangerous as you think I am. So in the Middle East, when one enemy or the other behaves in such a way, it's perceived as weakness. In the Middle East, you don't engage with an enemy. You isolate him, you weaken him, you kill him. You don't. You are not nice to him. That's not part of the repertoire, the usual repertoire. And this was, of course, perceived as further weakness. And with the Arab Spring, it was further amplified. An America that betrays an ally, like Mubarak, basically the president said he should be replaced. All dictators, what do you mean he should be replaced? I may be replaced as well. He's not going to get a great democracy in Egypt. So what is it? Gaddafi. You allow the Europeans to go after Gaddafi. Of course, you had to have them, you have enough ammunition and other things. But Gaddafi, after all, behaved. He sold oil. He gave up weapons of mass destruction. You're going to get anything better. You got the answer in Benghazi. It's worse. So, and the Middle Easterners understand that you are not going to get a democracy. They are not that foolish. What are the Americans doing? The worst, I think, was to criticize the Saudis for intervening in Bahrain. They intervened in Bahrain to support a Sunni dynasty, which is ruling over a majority of Shiites. And the Iranians were making troubles there, and the Saudis decided to intervene in Bahrain. You don't do things like that, simply. And the Saudis, from what I know, are putting money on Romney now. All this, is viewed in the Middle East as American failures, American weakness, as in America, it doesn't get it. Basically, you don't know what's going on. What all this means for Israel? First of all, strategic surprises. We invest a huge amount of money in our intelligence apparatus. And nobody there could see that Mubarak would be in a cage. I don't know if you remember this picture, unbelievable picture of Mubarak in a cage with his two sons. Frankly, I don't blame them. I don't think that we can prevent strategic surprises. It's very difficult to foresee historic discontinuity. But this means that we are in for maybe other strategic surprises, and we should prepare for worst case analysis. This should be our modus operandi. For too long, Israel has engaged in rosy scenarios. Another rosy scenario, the peace treaty with Egypt. We believe, many believe, okay, we got it, we need those great concessions, territorial concessions, and we'll have a peace with Egypt for eternity. Well, it was not eternity, but I think it was a very good deal we got, but it's now in danger. It changes. Political settlements are dependent on political developments, and domestic political. This can change in the Middle East quite quickly. quite abruptly. And we have to prepare for worst-case analysis. Another repercussion from an Israeli point of view is growing regional isolation. Unfortunately, we once had good allies, important allies, such as Iran, Turkey, and we lost them. We lost them because of domestic political developments in those countries. Actually, both countries have turned into rivals, enemies of Israel. Iran is, of course, more open about it. Turkey is much more cautious about it, which makes our situation more difficult. Also, the peace process, which in my view is basically a historic reluctant acceptance on part of the Arabs of Israel is a fait accompli. None of them became Zero Zionists. And this has been frozen. We should not expect any improvement in Arab-Israeli relations because of growing power of Islamists. It will make more difficult even for those elites that are willing to make deals with us to do it over the table. What is left will be done under the table. Of course, the United States, a weaker United States, or perceived weaker United States, is less able to compensate the parties to the peace process for risks they are taking. The America leverage in the Middle East was if you could push parties to the negotiating table and tell them, okay, you take this risk, we'll pay. And then, in one form and another. Now America is economically in trouble. It's not perceived as reliable also. So it's much more difficult to bring the parties to the table. The peace with the Palestinians, of course, in great danger. The Palestinians even don't want to come to talk. The American administration is unable to convince the Palestinian Authority, that is dependent on Pan-American and European money, to come to the negotiating table. Abbas is saying no to the President of America. Who is Abbas? He does it because he says that the President of America is weak and there's nothing to and you will give him anyway. The Palestinians, who are important part of this peace process to some extent because they have maybe a greater legitimizing functions than others, are not able to get closer to Israel. So we see a greater isolation in Israel in the region, which, you know, to some extent, it's not so terrible. We really don't want to be part of the region. I'll never send my students to the rest of Syria or Damascus. Don't forget the Arabs are poor despite the myths that they are rich. So what they can buy from us, it's very little. The economic purchasing power of the Arab world is very limited. Our markets are elsewhere. America, China, India. We're also moving to the Asia Pacific. We have moved our export orientation to this region for some time. There is another problem, this is deterrence. Israeli deterrence is, of course, partly result of Israel's military might. Basically, do they fear us or not? This is deterrence. Excuse my lack of political correctness. Fear is the best political currency in the Middle East. And they're fearing us because they get weaker, fairness. And actually the power differential between us and them is growing. But deterrence is not dependent only upon our military might, but also on the perception that in case of need, in case of crisis, the American will be with us. And this perception has been weakened because, as I mentioned before, America is not seen as a reliable ally, it's seen as an ally that is ready to sacrifice its friends. And this, of course, this type of perception might invite aggression. It lowers the threshold of fear on part of the others. So we are influenced by how America is perceived in our region, if we want it or not. In any case, we'll always be viewed as an ally, as a lackey of the Americans. Some even adhere to conspiracy theories. They say we run Washington. Yeah, some of American professors also say this. That's a different story. So another problem is the new elites. The new elites, particularly the Islamists, may miscalculate. You see, they are very good. They have experience in providing social services. They have good experience in providing education services, medical services. They've done it for years, and actually they have replaced the state that failed to deliver. This explains, basically, the appeal of political Islam. They've done a good job. They were good to their people. They are also somewhat more honest than the dictators, less corrupt. So, but they have no experience whatsoever in national security. They have no experience in foreign affairs. And I'll give you one example of miscalculations that has happened. This is the demilitarization of Sinai. This is the most important clause, from our point of view, in the Egyptian-Israeli peace deal. We termed it as a cold peace, basically they did not normalize the relations with us, but the relationship was extremely stable because 200 kilometers of desert in which there were no heavy arms, no missiles against airplanes, this allowed each side to feel somewhat secure. We couldn't surprise them, they cannot surprise us. You know, to go through the desert, it takes time, it gives a few hours of early warning. And for the Islamists, the demilitarization of Sinai is an affront to the Egyptian sovereignty. And actually, we know that Morsi, the president, has ordered part of his army, and we had the mechanized formations going into Sinai, and it took time for us to talk to the Americans, for the Americans to talk to them, to send them back beyond the Suez Canal. But this may happen again, and for us this is a casus belli, or could be a casus belli. We've been in Sinai in 48, 56, 67. We may do it again, in order to establish, you know, a better border, a defensible border. There is another area of concern, this is terror. We may see increased incidents of terrorism for two reasons. First of all, as countries lose the grip over their territory, we see greater freedom of action for sub-state groups. In Libya, Syria, in Sinai. Sinai is Somalia for all. It's a new Somalia. We have a lot of groups of a variety of political colors that are operating there. So there's greater freedom of action. But there is also greater ability to have access to weapons because those countries are less able to defend or to guard their military assets. We've seen arms, sensitive technologies like missiles against airplanes from Libya moving into Gaza. Now there is serious concern in Israel, maybe elsewhere as well, about the future of the chemical weapons in Syria. Because Assad, we are not sure that he is able to be in control for long over this type of very sensitive weaponry. And it Hezbollah may take over the other groups that are not much nicer from our point of view. So this is a problem. Another issue which is very problematic and it's not discussed enough in my view is the East Mediterranean. If we take a look at the map, and as Marines know the seas better than other Americans, from my experience, Americans are not always very good at geography, but in the East Mediterranean, take a look. Tunisia, 27. East of Tunisia is Libya. Libya under Gaddafi is also close. Now, there is obviously greater, they were not successful in the elections, only partly successful. They couldn't take the country, but obviously we see greater political clout for the Islamists in Libya. Egypt, the most important Arab country, is Islamist. Parliament, president, and the military is infiltrated. By the way, a colleague of mine has done some research on the religiosity of Arab armies, and the Egyptian army is the most religious one. This doesn't mean necessarily that it's radical. You know, I'm most very interested. I'm not a feminist guy, but there is an infiltration of the officer corps by the Islamists. Egypt is Islamist, Sinai is Somalia, further east is Gaza. Gaza is ruled by Hamas. Hamas is an Islamic terrorist organization. Going along the coast, it's Israel. Thank God it's still a Jewish country. Further north, it's Lebanon. Lebanon is run by Hezbollah. You know, I remember Americans were very happy about the Sadr revolution when Hamas took over. Further north, you have Syria. Syria was never a friend of the West. And if there would be a change in Syria, and you know, I adhere to a Talmudic saying, never pray for a new king. But if there will be change in Syria, it's not going to be change for the better. Basically what we see now is that the Turks and the Saudis are propping up an opposition that is largely composed of Islamic radical elements. So this is Syria. Further north is Turkey, which I mentioned already, that has pronounced Islamic orientation. There is Cyprus. Cyprus has been historically a very strategic site. Read the Persian Greek Wars. Read Othello. Othello, did the Desdemona die? In Cyprus. It was the struggle between the Venetians and the Ottomans. The Brits are there today, and they have some feeling what's important to what's not important. They lost the empire, they are not the real power today. They understand that Cyprus is important. And the northern part of Cyprus is Turkey, the southern part is Cypriot. For the Turks, they walk, take the whole island, and there is an attraction in taking the island because of the newly developed gas fields in the East Mediterranean, along Gaza, Israel, Cyprus, and actually the Turks already extracted from the Cypriot government a promise that there will be partners in developing and having the revenues of the gas fields. Now it's a mafia-type partnership, but now it happens. In our part of the world. And afterwards we have Greece. By the way, the Turks really want, I think, the gas fields not only because the source of revenue. They have an ambition, and they worked on it, to be bridge, energy bridge, between East and West. It's a Baku Jahan pipeline, or another pipeline. So this is part of their geostrategic aspiration. Greece, is there, but we all know what kind of, if you visited Greece recently, It has a large navy, but you know, it doesn't have any money. I think the Germans are fed up paying for them. And Greece, of course, is not somebody that is able to stop the Turks. Israelis are now very co-opted by Cypriots, by Greeks. You know, will you defend us? I actually was a month ago in Greece, and I was bad news. We are not going to fight for you. But so they look for the Russians. And by the way, the Russians might be more reliable than others. Because they need a port. The Russians need a port. Because if Syria goes the other way, Cyprus is the place for them to have a port in the East Mediterranean. And don't forget, in the Balkans, due to the great strategic American wisdom, we have three Muslim states, Bosnia, Kosovo, and Albania. In all of them, we see Iranian presence. In all of them, we see Turkish presence. This was part of the Ottoman Empire. And for the Turks, this is their natural sphere of influence. For the Iranians, anything that was once Islam should be returned to Islam. They are even talking about Andalusia. Anybody knows what Spain is? Until the end of 15th century, Spain was ruled by Muslims for 5th century. So this is the situation in the East Mediterranean. From an Israeli point of view, you should understand that 90% of our exports go by the Mediterranean. The most important, the most important issue, which was left away, it's juicy stuff. The most important issue was actually neglected during the Arab Spring. It's Iran. Everybody got busy. It's Tunisia. And Egypt more important, but the Iranians gained another year to work on the nuclear weapons. So what can Israel do? I think we need a larger army. We need at least one more division, because on the south, there are two borders now, which have been quiet for years, and now they are being challenged. In the south, there are attacks from the Sinai, there are attacks from Golan Heights, because Assad does not always control the area. So we need to invest larger funds into the military, the army, but also the navy. We have to defend our newly found gas riches in the Middle East. It's not enough to have legal rights to something. It's maybe good in America, to hold the title to something. In our part of the world, we have to back it up with force. We have to invest more in R&D. Actually, Israel is very good about it, to invest a larger proportion of money in R&D than most, maybe all countries in the world. And because this is our edge, we have to maintain our edge, to put our systems in the American systems we get, all the small boxes that make sure that we are doing well in war. Missile defense is very important. The IDF has neglected for years the missile defense, because it has a preference, which I can understand, for multi-mission weapon systems, and the missile can do just one thing. It should be missile. That's all. We have the best technology probably in the world, but we have to deploy to build those batteries, Iron Dome, and the second tier, which if you want to talk about it, I'll be happy to take questions. Another issue is defensible borders. We have to maintain defensible borders. We can't take chances that we are willing to take chances a few years ago because of rosy scenarios. We have to forge, continue to nourish the alliance with the United States. Let's face it, for us, America is the only game. We cannot be like Nasser, can go to the Chinese, can go to the Russians. We are tied to the United States, and we like you, but we also need. And this is the situation, and I think every Israeli government will understand that this government, Netanyahu, the world tensions between him and the president, you know, he was not given dinner, so oh, he had to send a chance or something. He didn't make an issue out of it. This is very important. Apart from that, we have to develop relations, which we are doing with other countries. You know, South Sudan is a new country, Greece, Cyprus, Romania. But all this, we should remind, don't carry the same way like Turkey. So we have a problem. Finally, the last point which I want to make is Iran. The hours of decision is getting closer. I think that most Israelis, and particularly the government, understands that diplomacy has run its course. Sanctions are not unable to change the strategic calculus of the Iranians on the issue of the nuclear issue. You know, they are hurting, but they are not giving it up. And therefore, it's only military actions that has to be taken. And the evaluation in Israel is that the Americans are not going to do it for their own reasons. And it will be left to us, once again, to do the dirty job for the world. And the last sentence is, you know, I described not a very rosy picture, but I think Israel is a strong country. Can invest more money in defense, has a great social resilience, ready to fight, and with the right leadership, will continue to be a great success story. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I told you you will not get warned nor you'll be provoked. If I may, I'll ask a quick question of a country that you did not name, and then we'll open the floor. That's Azerbaijan. I know it's small, it's not Turkey, but there's a lot of stories in the media, at least, that the Israeli relationship with Baku are getting chummier, and that now it's also a military relationship, not just a civil aviation and all that. Is there any truth to that or not? Thank you.
There is truth. I don't know what you mean exactly, but of course we have relations with them. We buy oil for them. We supply weapon systems. It's a country which is has border with Iran, which allows us you know, certain sure intelligence operations via Azerbaijan. And I think that Azerbaijan is a cautious country. It is very much afraid of Iran. So. If we need an air corridor, you know, the Saudis will give it to us, not Azerbaijan. There may be, under certain circumstances, a place for low-profile military activity toward Iran from Azerbaijan, but Azerbaijan is small, there are 9 million. That's all. The Iranians. If Iran gets nuclear, we can forget about the Azerbaijan. That's the case. So then what? They are now for West, like no, Central Asia will go if Iran gets there.
Thank you. Anybody? Please.
You mentioned engagement was seen as a period as a sign of weakness. Can you not engage from a position of strength, though?
Yeah, you meet somebody and then I also talk to them.
Yeah. You know, the fact that you want to interact with someone, okay, why is it seen as a sign of weakness?
Look how they behave. You want a meeting tomorrow, they say, no, we'll do it in a month. Comes a month, I will delay. We are busy, we have something else. We don't have time for the meeting. You want to engage them, you know, they are laughing at you. You know, it's... did the policy of engagement bring any change in Syrian policy? or in Iranian policy. Now you try to be nice, open the dialogue. They are ready to talk. This is, by the way, they're ready to talk for 15 years almost. They are very good at talking. This is a strategy, talk and build. Like the Korea. You look at the Korea. Korea's passed all the thresholds, crossed all the thresholds, and what happened next? For them, they speak about you like the Chinese spoke about you in the years of the Cold War. A paper tiger, right? That's the expression? No, this is what they say. And you can say, okay, I'm strong. But to be strong, you have, you know, to use your muscles once in a while. And you get out of Iraq, you get out of Afghanistan. By the way, I'm not advocating that you should stay in Iraq or Afghanistan. I thought that you should have left much earlier. My model of operation, and I was not against the war in Iraq. I said, you go in, take the bad guy, cut his head, put it on a spear, and go. That's, you know, this is what the Romans did. Punitive action, right? Punitive expedition. This is very useful. The Romans, you know, tried to create a Roman world, bring Roman culture, but not to every place. No, they realized the barbarians beyond the Rhine, you know, are not up to be Romanized. So, I think you made a huge mistake believing that you can impose your model, which I very much appreciate. I would love America to conquer the whole world and to make it like America, in the image of America. But, you know, you have limits to your power, unfortunately.
Yeah. Professor, I got a question here. You, to kind of counter some of what you said there, you talked about how the U.S., we failed to back Mubarak specifically, and saying we kind of gave up on our dictator allies, if you will. From a strategic perspective, if we're really thinking long term here, is the enduring backing of dictators in the face of a demographic that's rising? We live in a globalized world where people have access and they understand they're being oppressed on the street. Is this something that can last into the next 20 years as a policy? And if I give you the U.S. perspective, which I'm sure you're very well read on, but where we believe that if the people actually are responsible to one another, that at some point, maybe not in the near future, but in 5 years, 10 years, a strategic outlook, that some form of moderation and normalcy as governments are held accountable by the international community, that there will be some form of moderation as opposed to this radical version that for so long has kind of gotten away scot-free, not being held accountable, because they haven't had to be. They're not accountable to other nations in the world. So in this realistic environment, is continuing to pour money into oppressive dictatorships, is that enduring? And I just want to challenge your comments and basically get your perspective on that. I guess more of in a discussion,
Listen, I obviously understand your dilemma. We have the same dilemma now with the PA. The PA, Palestinian Authority, is in terrible crisis, and there are people on their side, it's terrible, it's authoritarian, and we have a dilemma, a strategic dilemma, should we support them or not? And because we support the bad guys. Abbas is not, his sons are making a fortune at the expense of American and European taxpayers. So sometimes you do things because you want stability. You know, there are two values here. Stability vis-a-vis promoting democracy, which I think it's very important. You know, I think it's important to try to export democracy. You did it successfully after the end of World War II, under very different circumstances, of course, in Germany and in Japan. But it's that's a dilemma, but I think that in the short term, you have to be realistic, you are not going to get anything better. After all, there is a Cold War, you supported Russia, it was more than 20 years to support the dictators. By the way, you are also not consistent. This is very intriguing, because in 2009, there was a chance, I don't exaggerate, it was a slight chance for regime change in Iran. When the people demonstrated, were not necessarily the liberal Democrat elements, but America didn't do anything.
You know, Professor, all due respect, I reject that claim 100%. I hear it all the time. Mousavi, you know, was not a realistic alternative to Ahmadinejad. I mean, these guys are the same person with different names, essentially. We're not going to get a shift in policy. The 1 million or so folks that poured out in North Tehran, these are the wealthy elite with family members living in the West. And you know, have a ton of money. None of them are willing to fight and die for regime change. That thing was over before it began. And you know, our U.S. Department of State actually concluded that Ahmadinejad did win that election. So I mean, yeah.
But is the Muslim Brothers a better alternative than Mubarak?
I don't know. In 10 years, we might find out.
No, very optimistic. That's typical American. No, I'm serious.
I understand your pessimism and your concern for the, you know, these are existential threats to your nation, but you know, there is other sides to these arguments.
Of course there are other sides. I don't claim to be the messenger of God here. Mm-hmm. I say what I think.
Yeah, well, so I have...
You are entitled to think differently.
I have 4 points I'd like to raise. First of all, You've said that with regard to Egypt, that strategic surprise was not preventable, that discontinuity was somehow not predictable. And I have one of my students from last year here, not one of my students from 2 years ago, but if I had a student here from 2 years ago, he would have told you that I taught my seminars that the situation in Egypt was not stable, that therefore the the Egyptian peace treaty with Israel, which was the linchpin of the security structure, could not be relied upon because the government of Egypt was being held down by its own weight. It had no enthusiasm, there was no enthusiasm for it, there was no possibility, it was not mobilizing people strongly in its favor. So the time and manner of the fall of the Mubarak regime was not predictable, the likelihood that it would, in some fashion, that in particular that there would probably not be a successful generational transition, I think, was predictable. Secondly, you said that Israel. Of course.
I agree with you, but basically, you know, intelligence officer. Has to tell the politician, listen, the next year we don't expect change. You know, we are talking about practical, you know, what is the horizon of the intelligence forecast?
That's a very very effective response. Secondly, it seems to me that when you're saying that Israel can no longer afford rosy scenarios, that's essentially saying that Israel can no longer afford the idea of land for peace, because land for peace is exchanging something concrete for something for an abstraction which ultimately depends on hope. So I'm not that's not a point of argument. That's just a trend, glossing what you're saying in different words. Third thing, Turkey's enormous significance for this region. Do you see a tension between Turkey's geopolitical imperatives and economic imperatives and the Islamist agenda of the AK Party? Or do you think that they're more or less congruent? And lastly, you didn't use the word Kurd, so I think we owe the Kurds some attention and looking at the future instability.
Let's start with the Kurds. The Kurds are very divided. Their national movement has not been successful for years to establish a state, despite that there were occasions to do so. They are reminiscent of the Palestinians. In current situation, obviously I would welcome some kind of Kurdish entity, because there are many chances that this entity will be friendly to Israel. And of course we do work in Kurdistan. We are very careful not to do as long as we had good relations with Turkey, with a few exceptions. But we are there, and particularly in the Iranian context. The issue of land for peace. First of all, we can acquire more land and give it. That's one way to deal with the situation. But it's true, I'm not in favor of transferring the Golan Heights to a Syrian, whatever will be there. On the West Bank, it's a different situation because it's heavily populated by Arabs, and I adhere to the two-state solution. Unfortunately, it doesn't work.
Did you say adhered in the past tense or adhere in the present tense?
Adhered in the past, because it doesn't work. I think, you know, it's a good... I'm in favor of dividing the land between the Palestinians and Israelis, and living, but I don't think it works for two reasons. One, that they are not ready for historic compromise with us. Second, that given the opportunity to establish a state, they failed. They lost, you know, it was fragmented. Hamas took part of it. Basically, the PA is living on Israeli bayonets. Every night, Israeli units go into the West Bank, pick up a few bad guys, bring them over, they squeal on their friends, they sit in jail, don't become better citizens. And this is what happens. This is what keeps Abbas in power. It's not, you know, there is a mess about the American-trained militias. They are infiltrated by Hamas. They are working only during day. You know, there is some kind of division work. We do the night. They do the day shift. But I don't think that they will fight Hamas. The two-state solution is not working. In the West Bank, what is important is the Jordan River, the area along the Jordan River. And this, will, in my view, has to stay under Israeli control. And I think most strategists in the world understand this and doesn't think this is some kind of unreasonable territorial appetite. What was the last...
The question was whether Turkey's... Yeah. Geopolitical situation will force it to diverge from the Islamist agenda, or will reinforce the Islamist agenda?
I think that the Turkish appetite started before, and it's a result of the end of the Cold War, with the Russian threat over, which was the main threat, historic Russian. Turkey, you are a story, and with this over, and after all, Russia is a weaker actor, so they have energies for other parts. And this is one, in my view, one main reason for going to the Middle East. And as long as Russia is not a real threat for them, they will not get closer to the West. They needed the West vis-a-vis Russia. That's all, basically. In geostrategy. So with the Russians are out of the equation, they play their games in the Middle East, they go back to their old dreams. I'm not sure that domestically Erdogan is winner in final analysis. If Erdogan goes for health reasons or for other reasons, there is still a strong nationalist, secularist, westernized elite that has a chance to take it back. You know, the problem is that they were corrupt. I don't want to go into what's happening in Turkey. Although I have a lot of friends in Turkey, and what I see is very much of concern. Some of them send their children abroad, not to study, to stay. When the elite loses the drive to run the country, it may be over. So I don't know how widespread this phenomenon is. I see it from my...
Which right now we don't have very close, but wouldn't you add that as part of it? That they actually tried to be part of the EU, but they were shunned at every stage that they were trying.
I agree that the Europeans didn't know how to handle the Turkish issue. They could have finessed the issue in some way. I'm not sure the Turks would agree. There are proud people. I don't know how many some of them are most of them. They're proud, and they know, they were slapped in the face once and again. They say, okay, I lose it. Some of people think, you know, we were at the gates of Vienna 300 years ago. I'm not sure the Yanishavis cannot march again. This is part of it. I also understand the Europeans not wanting Turkey, not only because it's Christian and they are Muslim. There are 70 million, you know. The East Europeans wanted Turkey in because they wanted to neutralize Germany. The Poles, you know, because, you know, 70 million people, you know, they are small nations, there's no kids. The Europeans do other things, not families. So, we're afraid of this great mass of people that would come in. They see Turkish. Emigres in their country which do not always integrate easily. So this is something which is just threatening to the Europeans. But they could have definitely finessed the issue. Actually, Israel helped Turkey, tried to help them. Shimon Peres, on many occasions, tried to educate his friends in Europe to be more responsive to the Turkish attempt to integrate in Europe.
Professor Mark, going back to the importance of the U.S. relationship with Israel as part of its strategic deterrence and posture in the world, as you say, there's this perception around the region that the U.S. is pulling back, and I'm wondering if, you know, in the cases you cited of Iraq and Afghanistan and not supporting Mubarak, if that extends to us not dealing, I guess maybe in their minds, effectively with the Iranian nuclear issue. And, you know, again, the West may say that, well, we're, you know, exhausting all other options remain on the table. But from Israel's point of view, it seems as if you've reached this decision point of a serious existential threat and possibly not rupturing but disrupting your key strategic alliance. And, you know, again, this isn't a political issue, it's not, you know, the Obama
administration. It's not the alliance.
Well, if Israel was to take matters into their own hand, okay, and to act. And, you know, Bibi gave the speech at the UN, it looks like we pushed that off a bit. But clearly the Obama administration doesn't want to go in this direction. And, you know, to be fair, the Bush administration told the Israelis don't do it either. So how do you square this circle? How do you, especially in a situation where the Iranians may proceed along at the subcritical level, not break out, and just keep amassing 20%, 50% HEU, whatever it may be. And as you say, you know, the West may have a tendency to be ostriches and stick their heads in the sand. If Israel reaches a point, though, where they say enough is enough and we have to act, how can they do that at the same time and not have get the U.S. to stand behind them. And you know, right now, there's, for those who don't know this, there's the largest U.S.-Israeli military exercise going on right now. It's the missile defense. I don't know if there's a Marine Corps component or not, but you know, clearly the U.S. is there to support Israel and has said so in many ways and has demonstrated it. But there is this realistic danger that the Israelis may feel that they don't have another option. And, you know, critics will say, well, Israel, the IDF doesn't have the capacity to do what the U.S. could do. That may not, at the end, make a difference. So how do you, again, you know, these two strategic imperatives, how do you reconcile?
From an Israeli perspective, of course, the American reluctance, we understand it. And, I think one of the issues that have delayed so far Israeli action is the discussions with American about the day after. We are ready to go with them. But if we are successful, hopefully, then we need some international support to make sure that the Iranians don't start immediately the program in terms of sanctions or cutting. Will be some kind of international consensus that, okay, Israel has acted unilaterally, but post factum, it was a good thing, and we will support. This is part, the Israeli debate is also about the covert operations. Dagan, the former Mossad chief, seems to claim that there is still a chance to stop the program through covert operations. I don't know enough how it is correct or not. If it's correct, I would agree with his argument. Military use of force is last resort. Now, about America. Listen, we've done things like this in the past. 81 was not with American blessing. 2007, the Americans were involved much more than before, but they said, okay, you do it, it's your responsibility. From an Israeli point of view, if we can do it operationally, we don't need an American person. We don't ask permission. Because we don't want to burn you being allied with us on this issue, despite the fact that the region will need to say, okay, it was called it, I know how the heads are working there. But even if we say no, you know, there is a beautiful Israeli song, excuse me, it's a girl's here, or it's a woman, excuse me.
Just the
title of the song, what does she mean when she says no? I know in America, no is no. We live in a different culture. Well, no, you know, it's maybe later. I don't know. So this is a notion. So we are, you know, even a clear no, American no, is not necessarily a no for us. Depends who says it, how he says it.
Red lights, green lights, yellow lights.
Yeah, amber light. Right. You know, there is an important article by Zev Shiv, the famous military analyst, about the war in Lebanon in 82, in which he says, yeah, the Americans, there was an amber light. The American said, no. But, you know, if you take a look at what was there, probably there was some kind of thing. So, I think that Israelis also realize that the repercussions, or the reaction, or the expectations of Iranian reactions are greatly exaggerated. So we can manage you alone. We don't need you immediately. We need you, Americans, more for the political world. But we expect to be blamed. Everybody will clap in private. We know the international importance. So I don't think this will be an issue in American-Israeli relations. If we do it, maybe the administration will be relieved. Okay, this is off the table for me. It's no longer an issue. So, There are many sides to it.
It's just a direct continuation. Professor, your opinion, if you would do it, when would you do it? When would be the right circumstance for us?
Tomorrow.
To do it.
Okay. Particularly after being said, you know, it's there and we have a problem. There is no strategic surprise, right? Everybody knows what we want to do. Yes, exactly. So we have to find a tactical surprise. So in this respect, I don't know what Netanyahu did, but this speech could be preparations for an operation tomorrow. Because everybody was relieved, right? You said he delayed it. Oh, wonderful. So they can sit, we'll wait a little bit. I will do it tomorrow. I don't think there is no need to wait. All the elements are there.
No, please go ahead.
Well, I just, I mean, what makes you think Israel, or, I'm sorry, Iran would even use it if they had it? What, I mean, again, this is strategic. Nobody who has the nuclear weapon, including Korea, has even shown that they can test it, has used it. So why do you make the immediate jump into the logic that they would use it and that they would create, you know, havoc?
You missed my my talk last time, in which I actually I argued that the political repercussions of the nuclear Iran are extremely severe. I alluded to it already. If Iran has a nuclear weapon, Central Asia goes. If Iran has a nuclear weapon, we have nuclear proliferation in the Middle East. If Iran has a nuclear weapon, it may be transferred to terrorists. If Iran has a nuclear weapon, it would affect the Pakistani nuclear posture. It would affect the nuclear balance in the Indian subcontinent, maybe with China. So I'm talking about tremendous political repercussions, the loss of credibility for the West. You know, the West said, it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable, and tomorrow, then, what happens to the credibility to the world? So I'm not talking about, you know, people think that I'm concerned about myself. This is not the, I think that the whole Middle East will change it much beyond it if they have a nuclear weapon. And therefore, it must be prevented. By the way, I will venture to say that a nuclear weapon on Israel is not the end of the world. The Jewish people have survived a Holocaust in the previous century. We lost 6 million people and women. How much will be a bomb? 20,000? 30,000? No, we have Hiroshima, and we are, the Israeli cities have been different than Hiroshima. There it was wood here. So, it's terrible a nuclear bomb in Tel Aviv. Well, some part of Tel Aviv. Okay, I don't want to confuse the politics. But it's not the, only the use. You're thinking, I think, I don't want to be, you know, to insult anyone. I think it's a very simplistic way to look at the problem. Will they use it or not? By the way, are you ready to take the chance that you are wrong?
No,
people are saying, okay, it will be better, contained. Are you ready to take the chance?
You're right.
5%. 5%. What?
That's a preemptive. You're taking a chance by saying you're right by starting preemptive war. That also creates havoc. It disrupts the alliances. It disrupts the Middle East in a much more real way.
Come on, everybody would be happy in the Middle East if we do it.
Except for the Iranians, of course.
Oh, okay.
And the Armenians.
Professor, I got it. This about the nuclear issue, we're quick to go to war, and we're quick to talk about war. And I agree with you. I don't think a weapon in Iranian hands is acceptable. But the political and then more so the economic implications are more of a threat to the regime than a single day strike on a nuclear facility that would perhaps press the, you know, the program back 5 years, maybe 10 years, ideally. But still, we're dealing with the Islamic Republic. What sanctions, and we say sanctions, you mentioned sanctions have been exhausted. I don't think they have. There's a lot of loopholes to these sanctions, where Europe, Kenya, South Africa, China, Japan are still importing Iranian resources. How do we make those sanctions more severe, or much like our internal tax policy in the U.S., how do we, you know, basically shrink those loopholes?
That's a very unsuccessful comparison.
How do we shrink those loopholes and to increase, to ratchet up this pressure? Because the economic and political pressure, that is actually a threat to the regime, not a single strike on a nuclear facility in the middle of the Iranian desert.
In my view, the nuclear problem is an issue responsible for the regime. First of all, and most important thing to have in mind, to have a nuclear bomb in order to ensure the survival of the regime. Because they understand that a nuclear country, outsiders will be more reluctant to destabilize. Because they don't know who will push the button. So this is, in my view, this is what they have in mind.
But how do we ramp up the sanctions? That's my question.
Sanctions. Listen, there is a history of international sanctions. You know, Castro was under sanctions. Saddam was under sanctions. You know, the regimes determined to pursue certain goals are not susceptible to economic pressure that affects primarily the people. Believe me, the mullahs eat well. They don't suffer. You know, the people in power, they are ready to see their people move on donkeys rather than cars because they want the bomb. It's very important to them. You see, to stay in power in the Middle East is extremely important. It's high-stake politics. Contrary to what's happening here, you have an election tomorrow, next week. Somebody wins, the other one goes into business. If he's ex-president, he establishes a library, he goes to garden. In the Middle East, you don't have too many retired presidents. It's a job for life. Those guys know if they lose power. Assad, if he loses power, he loses his life. His community, the Alawi community, will be massacred. So we are talking about different type of politics, which Westerners, unfortunately, do not always have a full grasp of. It's they cannot lose power, the revolutionaries.
But what's more of a, what's more of a threat to their...
They will be taken into the streets and tortured.
But they won't be tortured for not getting a nuclear weapon, but they will get tortured when the economy collapses and the bazaar collapses in Tehran and people stop working. And that's a threat to the regime. Now, because we have the foundations, you mentioned the Green Movement.
The Chinese the Russian are there. I don't see, you know, the whole international community gambling. There are so many outsiders that are not willing to cooperate with this type of, you know, foolproof sanctions that you are talking about.
We are running out of time here, but Professor Hidma is here. He's actually on base tonight, so as we go ahead, I don't want to impose on him. Those of you who want to hang around and talk to him, please do so. He is here. We can also have a cup of coffee and talk, so please take that opportunity. But the formal session is ending, and I thank you. We give you a little token of your presence here. Thank you very much again. And it also shows you, illustrates to those of you who don't read Middle East every day, that sometimes the books we read are not pushing the realities of the region. Sometimes they're not as cozy as we wish them to be. So thank you very much for coming here. Thank you.